Hey, Bruiser Buddies, this is Wrestling Nostalgia with Dave Dynasty.
Before we dive into the episode, make sure you hit subscribe on the podcast platform you're listening on. Also, follow me on X at The Dave Dynasty and subscribe on YouTube by looking up Nostalgic Dave Dynasty. You can also buy one of my shirts at ProWrestlingTees.com/TheDaveDynasty. Now, enjoy the show.
Welcome to 1 hour of the toughest, roughest wrestling you'll ever see.
That's right, Dick the Bruiser said it all.
The big question, have you got the endurance? Have you got the brains to get past the excellence of execution?
The reason why X and myself were put on this earth is to demolish people.
Bobby Heenan, that is a very good-looking sport coat you've got on.
Yeah, and I paid for mine. Mine isn't government issue.
Yellow, everybody. Lance Russell and Dave Brown right along ringside. By golly, we're ready to go with another big week of championship wrestling.
Greetings, wrestling fans, and welcome to Wrestling Nostalgia. I'm your host, Dave Dynasty. We are back after a week off. We have had all sorts of mishaps and scheduling problems and just personal stuff going on in my life. I'm a busy, busy man, and it's crazy, but I'm going to try not to miss any more episodes. I can't guarantee that because it's so wacky when you try to schedule people for interviews, and, you know, life happens. Stuff happens on my part, on the guest part. It's just a wild, wild thing, so... But on this episode, my guest is Scott Romer. We talk about Dick the Bruiser and the WWA. So let's just get to it. What do you say? Let's just take a break. And when we come back, I'll have my interview with Scott Romer. So stick around.
Hey, you bums. We have to take a quick break.
Phil Center Games is a tabletop cards and dice game company that has enjoyed success for over 3 decades. Their first game was Champions of the Galaxy and was released in 1986. Champions of the Galaxy is a tabletop game that features professional wrestling over 100 years in the future. Humans, aliens, and monsters battle in the Galactic Wrestling Federation for belts. Legends of Wrestling features officially licensed wrestling cards featuring stars like Ted DiBiase, Jimmy Snuka, Harley Race, and many, many more, including game sets for independent promotions. Each match takes place in real time. The action is fast and furious, and all the things that happen in pro wrestling, like cage matches, outside interference, three-man tag matches, they also happen in the games. You have the opportunity to run your own wrestling promotion involving either real-life stars or fictional characters of the future, or you can mix and match both. Visit PhilSingerGames.com for more information and to order the games today. That is PhilSinger Games, PhilSingerGames.com to order now. If you like horror movies, be sure to check out Dave Dynasty and Ike Isaacs on the Listen to Their Screams Horror Podcast. It is available on all podcast platforms and on social media at Listen to Screams. That is Listen, the number 2, and Screams. Hey ho, everybody. Subscribe to the Pinhead Pod, the Ramones fan podcast, bringing you interviews, news, deep dives, and much more. Look it up on your favorite podcast platform. That is Pinhead Pod.
We're back on Wrestling Nostalgia.
And welcome back to Wrestling Nostalgia. This time I'm being joined by photographer, wrestling manager, and author, who is also known as Saul Creechman, Scott Romer. Scott, how are you?
Dave, I'm doing wonderful.
Good, good, good. So we're going to talk a little bit. You've been on the show before, but we're going to talk a little bit. I got a lot of new listeners, and we're going to touch on some new stuff, but we want to give a little background. You're primarily a photographer. Was photography something you were always interested in? Was that a hobby as a child and everything?
Yes, it was. You know, back in the early 70s, I used to go to Bobby Leonard, who was a coach of the Indiana Pacers at the time.
Yep.
He had a summer camp, and every week there was a new group of people, of campers, and on a particular day, we would get our picture taken in as a group by the official Pacer photographer, and he would stand on a ladder and take a big group picture, and then they were available for sale, or maybe they mailed it to us. You know, we're talking over 50 years ago, but I was yeah. impressed. I was impressed with all the buttons and stuff like that. So I had a fascination with cameras, thanks to him.
Yeah. Okay. Well, then let's go the other route. What are your first memories of wrestling as a fan?
Well, as a fan, as a child, very young, you know, 3 or 4 years of age, we only had like 4 stations that we could get back in the day. And one of the stations played championship wrestling with Chuck Marlowe as the commentator. And wrestlers would get on TV and talk about the upcoming match and how they were going to beat so-and-so up. And it sort of impressed me because when I was in elementary school or nursery school or whatever, you know, there was always the tough kid on the in your class that would talk about beating you up. So it would always remind me of the tough kid. You know, I heard adults screaming at each other. I thought it was just the kids saying those things. And, you know, so it rang a bell and really got me interested in it. Now, in those days, we were on Championship Wrestling was on WTTV Channel 4. And it was sort of an independent station that didn't come out real clearly. So I remember playing with the rabbit ears antennas, trying to get it, a clear picture. And it was on very late in the evening. There was Sammy Terry's Nightmare Theater that came on first, and then Championship Wrestling. Now, I also, the person doing the, I may be getting ahead of myself, but the person doing the ring announcing at the live shows in the 60s was Bob Carter, who was also Sammy Terry.
Sammy Terry, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, so, well, and Chuck Marlowe, right? Chuck Marlowe did a lot of other things, right? He called some IU basketball, did a lot of other things.
Right. He had the Bobby Knight show, I think. John Punt, who was the coach of the Indian, was it IU football, and Lee Corso, I think, was another one. So he did independent sports commentating as well.
Yeah, yeah, and recently I had Dave McClain on, and you mentioned. You brought up elementary school or primary school, whatever you want to call it. Tell us the story of you and Dave running a wrestling show at your elementary school assembly. Not only that, but the show was attended by Sam Mendiker, correct?
That is correct. We went to a private school, so we were able to get away with a little bit more than what you would get at a regular school. And we always had a fascination for wrestling. And in the seventh grade, eighth grade, David and I would go to the shows together and take pictures with our Instamatic cameras and then sell them to the fans. During grade school, we came up with the idea, let's do a wrestling show for assembly. And we got the permission from the school, and we built a ring using elastic bands as the ring ropes. And we had an actual stage, and we made a little makeshift ring, and of course we did the crisscross, and it was like it was the same kind of material. Our ropes were the same kind of material as an underwear, so it was elastic. So we did the crisscrossing, but we invited the entire school to come and watch. And they weren't even aware of it. You know, we would go from classroom to classroom and, hey, there's an assembly. And, you know, before you know it, we had the entire school watching us. And we imitated what we saw on wrestling. We used, at the time, vampire blood to make it appear that we were really injured. And, I'll never forget little kids, you know, we had the kindergarten and first graders out there, and they were crying, and they were really upset because they thought that we were really hurt. But before the show, we had, I had Dick the Bruiser's telephone number because my uncle Jaime used to run his bar. He was the manager of his bar. What was it called? I forgot the name of it right off.
Yeah. What was it? I can't remember. Yeah, I can't remember either. Yeah.
So he ran the bar, and I had his telephone number, and I got David McLean to call Dick up, and Dick said, he's not interested in coming, or he wouldn't come, but he sent Sam Miniker. So we had... You know, we idolized these guys, and Sam Miniker was the ring announcer. He didn't know what to expect. So Sam saw us all imitating the wrestlers and using the fake blood. And after the show, he called David and I over to talk to us. And he was sort of upset, and he said, whose idea was this? And David spoke up and said, well, it was Scott and my idea. And he said, you two, you guys are a disgrace to the business. Jimmy Valiant's head and Bobby Heenan's head will never be the same. And because of all the cuts they've had. And here you guys are using fake blood and putting on this stuff. And then he called David over into the corner and said, that was a hell of a show. You're going to be a hell of a promoter one day. And, years later, David became the general manager of Championship Wrestling. And then he started Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling, which then transferred into Women of Wrestling. And to this day, he's got a gold mine. His business partner with Women of Wrestling is Jeannie Buss, who just sold the LA Lakers. For $10 million for $10 billion.
Yeah.
So, he really hooked up with the right people. And I myself have my own experiences. I was able to travel the world in wrestling. And in boxing and photograph the matches as well as I married Dick the Bruiser's daughter and he turned me into a wrestling / manager by the name of Saul Creechman. I was a mixture between Eddie the Brain Creechman, who managed the Sheik, and Saul Weingroff, who was a star in Tennessee. He worked briefly for the WWA in about 1975. So he came up with the name Saul Creechman, and I was the manager, around 1984, 1985.
And, well, tell us, because Dave talked about how he was running he did the Dick the Bruiser fan club, taking pictures, that led to him kind of getting a little more involved. How did you start taking pictures at the shows?
Well, we both did it together, and we came as fans and snuck up at ringside, laying real low and took pictures, and the policeman would throw us out and we'd crawl into the other side, the opposite side, so we wouldn't be seen. And we got away with it. And then we started selling them during intermission to the wrestling fans. And yeah. and we made a handful of money. It was really amazing. And
Then Bruiser wanted his cut, right?
we got one of the cops. His name was Cecil Maddalena. He was the head cop there, Bruiser's personal cop. And he called David and I over, and he said to us, the Bruiser wants to see you right now. And Vic had a couple of our pictures, and he said, are you selling these? And we both said, yes, sir. And he said, these are pretty good. You know, you can keep on selling them as long as I get 20%. So, each and every show that we attended after the matches, we were allowed to go upstairs, wait with all the wrestlers, who waited for their paycheck until our name was called. We were the last ones, and we'd go into the dressing room and hang into Bruiser and Snyder's private dressing room and talk to him for the remainder of the evening, you know, for, you know, 1 or 2 hours while he drank the Japanese beer and Wilbur had, I'm not sure. I think Wilbur drank champagne during that. And they were sitting there in their underwear, you know, we were in awe over this, We were the last ones to leave the beautiful air conditioning convention center with Wilbur and Dick. Sometimes it was at 2 o'clock in the morning that we'd end up leaving. And by that time, let me step back. When the wrestlers would wait, there was usually a cooler, a chilled beer. In one of those tubs, and it was all staff beer. So we would wait for an hour or two until our name was called, drinking the beer. Now, of course, we were underage at the time. Also, I forgot to mention that when we became the photographers at age 14, Bruiser made Sam Miniker drive us back home.
Dave mentioned that.
To the show, we would be dropped off at Sam's apartment and then, driven to the convention center with Sam and his wife. And there were a few times that he had wrestlers with him, Sergeant Jacques Goulet and Big John Studd a couple times. It was Lou Thez. And so David and I just kept our mouths shut. We were in the back seat, but we got a chance to look at, the back of their head. And at that time, we noticed that Lou was, he had his jet black hair, but he was bald in the back and, with hairy ears. Hairy cauliflower ears. We would sit there and do pantomime, point and look at his ear and look at the hair and hopefully they weren't looking at us, through the rear view mirror. We were just in cloud nine and we would drop. We would walk in with Sam Miniker and whatever wrestler. And, there were security guards back in the back, but they saw us walking in with Sam Miniker, and that was our key to getting in every time, what I mean?
Yeah.
To get in backstage, which gave us, access to getting pictures, dressing room shots of all the wrestlers, which, of course, we sold to as well.
Yeah. So how does it evolve from you, right, taking these pictures, you know, riding along, whatever, to being a manager? Where does that evolution, where do you get that? How are you approached by Bruiser or Snyder or whoever it is to start being on camera?
You know, I was, since David and I were photographers, then David became the ring announcer.
Right.
And I had Spike Huber and Michelle, Bruiser's daughter, were married. And, you know, Spike had a girlfriend on the side from Tennessee. That he had moved to Indianapolis. And not far from their house. Now, this was all a secret. And, you know, when he and Michelle went to bed, he would sneak out and push the car out in the driveway and then drive and have his thing with her, with the girlfriend, and then come back while they were still asleep. And I might be revealing a little too much dirt.
Nah.
It was over 40 years ago, so I guess.
Sure.
It's okay, and you know, everybody knows, I guess.
Yeah.
But sure. You know, there was a time, you know, Michelle woke up and there was no Spike Huber in bed with her at the time, and she went into the living room and he wasn't there, and you know, what the hell's going on? And she had called McLean up, and I think David spilled the beans and said, yes, he's got a girlfriend, you know, he had to play both sides of the fence, you know, without offending anybody. And, you know, Michelle wasn't, she went hysterical and, called up, Spike Huber's mother, and you know, Spike Huber's mother went over there to console Michelle, but also to protect Spike, because if Bruiser found out about it and saw how upset his daughter was, he would have killed Spike. So when Spike got done with his thing, he drove back and saw that his mother's car was in the driveway and realized he had been caught and stayed away for a few days until the heat wore off. And Bruiser sat on his porch with a shotgun waiting for him to arrive. So,
which, by the way, at this time, Spike's the champ, right? He's the WWE champion.
Yes.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Right. And Bruiser blackballed him from the WWA and whatever promoters were around at the time that he was friends with, keeping Spike from making a living. And then they were trying to sue him for all the money he was making. You know, he wasn't making money, but, oh, he's making a fortune. So they were trying to get a whole bunch of support from him. And of course he wasn't making any money because he was being blackballed. And then I was hanging around Carl, the Bruiser's son. This was in and out of, when he was out of jail at the time. And Carl and I went over next door to Michelle's house, and she gave me a big hug. And, oh, it's so good to see you. Why don't we get together? I didn't even know that Spike had left at the time. And we're going to have to get together. And then that's when I found out Spike was no longer in the picture. And she came over to my house, to my apartment. Now, I was only 23 or 24 at the time, and she came over in a beautiful Mercedes-Benz convertible, which was Bruiser's, and gave me the keys to the car and said, here, drive me to the shopping mall. And you know, here I am with this beautiful, a little bit older than me woman that was my childhood idol's daughter.
Daughter, yeah.
And we went to what was called the fashion mall, you know, Indianapolis's most expensive mall, and she went shopping, you know, so my assumption was that she had money. And which was fine. I would have married her without money, and she didn't have money, you know. You could buy whatever with credit cards, you know.
Sure.
But, so we were dating, we started dating, and Bruiser suggested that I move into the house. Oh, by all means. Oh, God, I'm going to be Bruiser's next-door neighbor, my childhood idol's next-door neighbor. I'm dating, I'm banging his daughter. And things couldn't be better.
Right.
And then he said, he told me to come over. He said, I want you to grow a beard, and I'm going to make you my next manager. So I started growing a beard, and that included he gave me the ring truck because Carl was back in jail.
Okay.
And all of a sudden I was the new ring guy.
Okay.
So I would have to drive the ring truck to the different venues and set up the ring, and then at the time, Calypso Jim joined in, so he and I would drive together to the different armories and have the painstaking job of setting up the ring, you know, many, many hours before the show even started.
Yeah.
But you know, he said, you're you know, I'm gonna call you Saul Creechman, you're now a manager. And my first time out on TV, he pitted me with Harley Race.
Right, yeah.
You can't get over any more than that, and I'd love to see that tape. Now, you have a great archive of WWA tapes. One day I hope that turns up. It was the first time I was out there, you know, I wore my suit, and I put on some obnoxious looking hat and carried a cane that was in Bruiser's yard, in Bruiser's garage, and wore a pair of old sunglasses, and I managed Harley Race.
Unreal.
And the rest is history, right? And let's not forget, during that time, I was also a photographer for Pro Wrestling Illustrated magazine, Bill Apter's magazine, and also Gong Wrestling magazine. So you put what I was making with Japan and with Bill Apter, and the little bit I was making for Dick the Bruiser, and you know, it really wasn't bad money when you put it all together.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, you know, in a profession that you've loved since you were a kid. I mean, you know, you're living the dream. But you, during this time, right, you weren't just a manager. You were like the manager, right? Bruiser always had that.
There was Dr. Jerry Graham, who was my mentor. He was the other manager.
Yeah.
You know, he managed Cashbox Kent and Greg Wojciechowski.
Yep.
Where I managed, my main team were the World Warriors, Mad Max and Super Max, who was Sammy DeCiro, who created Windy City Wrestling.
Yep.
And Mad Max was also Eli the Eliminator. In the
Wrestling Mid-South.
In Von Erich's territory in the Mid-South and stuff like that. I also managed the team of the Hogs, Lanny.
Yeah, I want to hear more about the Hogs, because I'm always fascinated by the Hogs, because they did a little bit in Memphis and this and that, but there's not a whole lot out there about them. But man, they were a pretty solid heel team. What was it like working with the Hogs?
You know, they were they were, you know, I had a ball with everybody. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Not only was I a manager, but I was also taking pictures in the dressing room and sending them into the wrestling magazines and occasionally getting their pictures published. So I was over with everybody, you know.
Yeah.
Everybody, and including, you know, and you know, people asked me if I had any difficulties with any of the wrestlers that I photographed. And no, the door was open. They loved me because I was a representative with Gong Wrestling Magazine, and I helped get them booked in Japan and the international exposure I got them. So, you know, I was accepted by everybody during that time. I would say, you know, now, it's a very backstabbing, vicious business. No, whatever they said behind my back, I don't know. They probably did. But
Someone can be your friend one day and your enemy the next. But
right. But you know, the wrestling photography and working with Japan's Gong Wrestling Magazine for Japan got me a pass to work with the WWF during their invasion. I was the first photographer that they allowed up at the ring to shoot with their own photographer, and his name was Steve Taylor. And his work was published in the WWF magazine, where my pictures were published in Japan. But I was working side by side up at the ring for a couple years with the WWF.
Yeah, which, I mean, for people that may not know, right, WWF cut off everybody except their guy for their magazine.
Right.
But then you, right, shooting for Japan, right? I guess we should mention that, right? Gong is that was the premier magazine in Japan. That was, you know, the wrestling magazine, right?
Right. So
that's a big deal.
Right. So my WWF pictures, and of course I was working with Gong Magazine long before that. You know, you got to also understand the powers of B in Japan wrestling, what was Inoki and Baba. And when they would come to the United States, they would fly me in and I would work with Baba and also Inoki.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's unheard of to work with all the different oppositions, including the WWF, but I got away with it.
Yeah.
You know, you couldn't work for the WWF and NWA at the same time, but I did. Yeah. So that makes me the only person in wrestling, in the history of wrestling, that got away with working with all the different organizations during the same time period.
Yeah.
Wait, I take that back. I think Harley Race was working, had his own promotion, Kansas City or the St. Mm-hmm. Louis Wrestling Club, and he was also wrestling for the WWF at the same time.
Right.
So I got away with it, which makes it a very unique situation.
Yeah, and as you transitioned to being on camera, right, and doing this man, doing Saul Creechman, did you ever have any issues in public with fans? Because right, that shifts, right? You may not be able to go to the grocery store.
Occasionally, there would be a person that would want to pick a fight with me at a bar or whatever, you know, and oh, that shit is all fake. And to avoid the situation, all I had to do was agree with them. You're right. That's why I'm doing it, dumbass. You know, and so, you know, oh my God, I would protect it 99% of the time, unless a bigger guy came up to me and wanted to pick a fight and there was nobody to back me up. You know, I'd agree with them. And then we became friends and that person would buy me a beer.
Yeah.
You know, so the same thing as the hot dog and the Coke, you know, I would get a free beer. Right. But, you know, but for the most part, We were on TV, you know, every week. And, my friends, nobody wants to admit that they saw me on TV. The best they would do was they were flipping through the channel looking for a show and came across me. You know what I mean? Mm. And it's the same as my book. You know, nobody wants to. I don't have one relative that admits to reading my book. Not one relative. You know, they're even in it. It's the strangest thing I've ever heard. You know what I mean? Now, my book, has a million and a half, over 200 pictures. And, it's an easy read. See Spot Run. See Saul Creechman Run. And nobody admits to reading it. Or they've gone through the first chapter, and they put it down and they haven't got to the rest of it yet. So I'm thinking, yes, they have read my book, but in reality, I did the things to make a living. I did what I loved to do, and that was taking pictures, and I made my living taking pictures of boxing and wrestling, which led me to working with very, very powerful people, which got me gigs with presidents and prime ministers and actors and actresses. I mean, I go to Hollywood parties with Robert Downey Jr. I go and I'm at events with the Kennedys. Yeah. So, and all that is in my book as well, not by my words, but with pictures of me working with presidents and stuff like that, So, with Secret Service protection and stuff, my book is very unique at the fact that I have transformed into working again with some of the most powerful people in the world that actually know my name.
Yeah. Well, let's go back here. You mentioned Carl Aflis, right? Dick's son, who you were friends with, who worked as Leroy Redbone.
Yeah.
And obviously had a troubled life, right? In and out of prison and other, I'm not going to go into all the, lots of stuff. What do you think the big issue with Carl was? How much of it was being the son of Dick, that wanting to be a wrestler so bad? What all was the issue with him and the prison and being in and out and all the trouble? And
he was institutionalized most of his life in prison, and I guess you get used to it. It's a lot easier 3 squares a day than having to face reality of the real world. I'm sure there was pressure being the son of Dick the Bruiser. And, I've heard stories that, when Carl would play football at his junior high school football team, the Bruiser would come out there and scream at him, "Why didn't you make that tackle, in front of everybody?" So, some of it might have been animosity, and some of it might be that he just was a bad seed. Bruiser's wife was a stripper. She was an Italian woman. So, and grew up poor. So it might have been environmental issues. You never know. But Carl, as soon as when he would get out of jail, Bruiser put a mask on him after he got out of jail and called him the Strangler because he didn't want to reveal his true identity. He was one of the many Stranglers that we had here. But we would do TV interviews. And, McLean would go, when Carl would get out of jail, and Leroy Redbone, "You've been traveling What have you been doing with yourself? I've been traveling the world, my brother. I've been all over the world. I've been wrestling in Mexico and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But in reality, he was, you know, in prison and in the Indiana farm or whatever they call it, you know, Pendleton.
Yeah, who came up with the Leroy Redbone name? Do you know? Was it Carl or was it Dick?
I think that was him.
Yeah, that's a kind of peculiar name.
I don't know. I think it was him, right?
Yeah.
Leroy Redbone, brother. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you talked about how, you know, photography, how many places it's taken you. I want to talk about, right, you attended David Von Erich's funeral in 84 for Gong Magazine. And not only that, but you got to interview Fritz at the Von Erich Ranch, right?
That is correct.
That's wild.
Yes. I had called Fritz up and told him I was going to be there. And if I'm not, let's see. There was when I was young and living in an apartment, there was this really hot girl living next door to me who worked for one of the health clubs. And she had moved to Dallas, Texas. Oh, she was hot. And she gave me her telephone number before she moved away. And let me see. I had called Fritz up and told him I have been assigned to the funeral. And I had called her up. And she came and picked me up from the airport. So we both went to the funeral. And it was completely packed with like 5,000 people outside, you know, fans outside. And they had a loudspeaker so the fans outside could hear the funeral. And as soon as they loaded David into the hearse, I approached Fritz and told him how sorry I was and gave him a hug. And the pastor of the church saw that and assumed that I was really good friends with Fritz and said, I'm going to the Von Erich house. Would you like to come with me? And by all means. So he was the first to leave the funeral procession. And we showed up we both went to the house and waited for the rest of the funeral people, you know, the family to come.
Yeah.
And I, of course, had that beautiful girl with me and Mrs. Von Erich or Mrs. Atkinson or whatever her name was, Dolores. You know, and there were other relatives and they were very nice, gave us coffee and hors d'oeuvres to eat. And all of a sudden in comes Bill After. And now I was there first before the funeral, before that everyone showed up. And then Bill After showed up. Man, was he surprised to see me there, you know? And I did an interview with the with all three of them together. I didn't spend a lot of time, and they were talking about Mike coming learning to wrestle, and I remember Chris, who was he was probably 13 or 14 at the time. And not very big. And, you know, and I sat down with Kevin and Carrie and proceeded to do an interview.
That's wild.
And then I sent my pictures to Japan and they, you know, it was a hot topic back then. I was the photographer with the press, with the Japanese press photographing the funeral.
Yeah.
So,
and the Von Erichs were big in Japan. I mean, they were popular in Japan.
Yes, they were. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So, so when Jerry Graham Jr. and his partners, you know, bought the WWA into the WWA and moved it to Detroit and then Toledo, did you ever have any discussions on working with them?
I wasn't working for Bruiser Bedlam at the time. No, I had slipped on some ice at Bruiser's house and broken my ankle. And, you know, during that time, the WWA was dwindling down quite a bit.
Sure,
and,
yeah.
Dr. Jerry Graham either became partners or bought a share from Dick the Bruiser and started running in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
And they called it Bruiser Bedlam. And
yeah.
At that time, no, I wasn't involved with the WWA at the time.
Gotcha.
No.
Okay.
Right.
Well, and you know, we won't go too in depth, but you also have had an almost equally amazing career photographing boxing, and you even dabbled in boxing yourself. Were you always a boxing fan also? I mean, back to childhood?
I was, you know, especially Muhammad Ali. And I remember when he was Cassius Clay and Sonny Liston Floyd Patterson. And again, I had a fascination with boxing as well. And as soon as I got my driver's license, I would go to the local boxing shows at the Tyndall Armory and do the same thing I did with wrestling. I would sneak up at the ring, take pictures. The cops would throw me out, and I would sneak onto the other side and take pictures. The promoter at the time, his name was Fred Burns. And, you know, he would ask the security to throw me out, and they would. And I would go around to the back, and the door would open up, and I'd sneak back in and climb the stairs and proceed to take the pictures. And my pictures were really good, and I became the official photographer for Fred Burns and his boxing. And I was selling them to the boxers and fans the same way, pictures to both the fans and the boxers.
It's crazy to think, though, right? You're still attending boxing at the Tyndall Armory to this day.
Yeah, right. Things haven't changed. That's the thing. You know, people have changed, but my lifestyle haven't changed. You know, boxing isn't as popular anymore since Fred Burns died or since he got out of the business. Now, getting back, if you look at my book, I had four mentors in my life during different times of my life because I had a father that never cared about me. And treated me like shit, and I got my ass whipped, and he was, you know, and I'm still a kid craving for a father attention, you know, so that's
right.
My dilemma, I guess you might say. But my father figures that helped elevate me to the moon and back were Sam Miniker, who drove me to the shows and back. And because I knew him, it got me my connections with Bruiser and the wrestling, the local wrestling. The other one was Fred Burns, who became my best friend and made me the official photographer for boxing. And not only that, but I would take the fighters overseas and babysit them and make sure their hands are taped and they got their proper training in. And when a fighter fought overseas, they made serious money, you know, like $20,000. They were paid in cash.
Yeah.
And customs only allows a maximum of $10,000. So I would carry the rest of the $10,000 in my underwear. So I was used as a mule. I was a mule for Fred Burns.
Oh.
And, you know, like wrestling, I wasn't paid very much, but I got to see the world for free and meet some very, very interesting people. My pay to be a mule and to babysit the fighter was usually $100. So, but what else am I going to do, right?
Right, yeah.
Let's see. The other one was a man by the name of George Randazzo, and he founded the National Italian American Sports Hall of Fame in Chicago. Okay.
Uh-huh.
And he was part of the syndicate. And in Chicago, they call the mafia the outfit. So if you ever watch The Untouchables, they talk uh-huh. about the outfit.
Yeah,
and
right.
So through that, I became the official photographer for the outfit, you know, which is
wow.
the dismantled mafia. And to this day, I still work for, well, it's not really called the mafia anymore, but I work to this day. I work with, you know, like Al Capone's lawyer's son, you know, who is
yeah.
the secretary of the National Italian American Sports Hall of Fame. So, you know, there are names that are part of it that I'm associated with the last name Gambito and all that other stuff. And I'm the official photographer and have been for over 30 years. And, you know, I don't know if they know that I'm just a Jewish hillbilly kid. They think I'm one of them. It's the most amazing thing that's ever happened.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And
yeah.
then I drive my my old Toyota back home. You know what I mean? But when I'm with
yeah.
these guys, I'm in limousines and being wined and dined and flown first class. And then, you know, and then I don't know where my next buck's coming from, but it sure is fun. And,
yeah.
You know, it was so fun that I never had children. And if I had children, I wouldn't be able to do the things that I did.
Yeah.
Because I'd have to work a real job. You
right.
know,
yeah.
So the downfall right now that I'm in my, you know, upper 60s is that I have no family, you know, no children that I have established,
yeah.
you know what I mean? But,
yeah.
but you know, I've got my memory still and the
sure.
pictures. And when I'm bored, I just look at the pictures and go, I did all that. Jesus Christ. How the hell did
right.
I get away with all that?
Right. Well, I mean, and like you thought, I mean, you've met world leaders, presidents, celebrities, you know, boxing and wrestling legends. What, off the top of your head, what would you consider probably the most awestruck you've ever been at someone you've met?
Well, you know, last year I was at a party, a bar mitzvah with Robert Downey Jr., who
yeah.
is also in my book. Now, Fred Burns' daughter, when she was in high school, she was also my secretary. She actually married Robert Downey Jr.'s wife's brother. And that is my connection to Robert Downey Jr. I was the official photographer through George Randazzo, who got me the gig, the National Italian American Foundation. They honor presidents.
Yeah.
I was also the official photographer for the Ellis Island Medals of Honor. And they honor presidents and the you know business people and war heroes and people that have made a difference whose families have immigrated to the United States from different countries through Ellis Island. You understand
right.
what I'm saying?
Yeah,
so
gotcha, yeah.
They've got it's a very prestigious award.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was their official photographer for a couple years. And I'll never forget, I was, you know, here I am on the red carpet carrying all this equipment. and I'm walking behind Tom Ridge, who was the first Homeland Security appointed by President George Bush. And and through both sides of the red carpet were soldiers from all different parts of the military, and including soldiers dressed up, or including including military soldiers dressed up from the 1700s, all lined up. And here I am carrying these boxes and stuff behind Tom Ridge, and they're all saluting him, and I'm right behind them. Can you imagine looking at all this and behind him in suit? And be I couldn't get my camera out because I had boxes, and I certainly couldn't drop the boxes to take pictures, because there were other, you know, the honorary guests were also walking the red carpet, and I I couldn't drop put anything down, otherwise they would trip over it. So it was the most unbelievable feeling that I could possibly get. But what's the word I'm looking for? I'm sorry.
Reminiscing?
Right. You know, when I was a WWF photographer and waiting by that entrance and the anticipation, and when Hulk Hogan would come out and I would follow him to the ring and the fans would scream and stuff. To this day, I still get goosebumps thinking about it. You know what I mean? And being a part of all that.
Well, and like you mentioned, in 2020, you published your autobiography, which coupled with author John Cosper.
Correct.
What made you what pushed that? What decided in 2020 that time period? What made you decide to release something at that point?
Well, you know, as I mentioned to you, that I didn't have a relationship with my father whatsoever, and he wrote me off as a goof, and he wasn't a very nice man, and I'm not ashamed to say that even after his death.
Yeah.
But I would come home from all these events and try to show my family the pictures that I had just taken, and also the tell my story, and they would listen to me. Through the life of me, it's interesting, even with the pictures, they wouldn't look at the pictures. They wouldn't listen to my stories. And then let's just say that we had a dinner, you know, a holiday dinner, and other relatives and friends were at that dinner table. And, and someone would say, well, Scott, what have you been doing lately? And I'd say, well, I just got back. You know, I was working with the president. You know, and before they would ask me any more questions, my dad would say, he's so full of shit. And that ruined my credibility with everybody. Nobody wanted to talk to me then. You know what I mean? Because they thought it was very, very frustrating. But in the meantime, I had all these pictures of me doing this stuff. Now, it would be, you know, I couldn't carry my photo albums with me and show people, you know what I mean?
Yeah, right, but,
you know, it'd take away from, you know, everybody else. So I would tell my dad, you know, one day I'm going to write a book. And he'd say, nobody gives a fuck about you or a book. And that gave me an incentive to get my pictures together and write a book. And I went to Jason Maple's show in Fort Wayne, and I saw John Cosper and Madman Pondo selling his book. And I talked to John Cosper and told him who I was and, you know, about my interesting life. And he said he would get back with me. And after he got done with Tracy Smothers' book, he called me up and said, I'm ready to start yours. And we met for lunch, and he brought a tape recorder with him and started tape recording. And I kept sending them pictures after pictures after pictures. It never stopped. And he said, Scott, you know, you keep sending me, I've got over 1,000 pictures of every, you know, and it never stops. Someday we're going to have to, we're going to have to call it quits on you sending the pictures. Otherwise, the book will never be published. And he chose what he thought were the best pictures that went with the stories that I told, and published the book.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you, Scott, from so many of us out here, your father was wrong. Lots of us give a fuck and are glad you published the book. And you do, man, you have had such a unbelievable life. And just the wrestling alone, but that's not even talking about the other stuff. But I am. I'm very glad you put the book out there. I'm hoping maybe someday we could just see a Scott Romer photography book, just a book of pictures.
Well, and, when I moved and I had a painter and he had the remote control to my garage, I came home from I think it was the Jerry Lawler tribute in Evansville. And most of my shit was stolen, you know what I mean? And so at this point, I'm going through whatever negatives I could find that are still in existence to try to recreate with what I used to have. And so some of that stuff may never be seen before. Also, it broke my heart, and I get mad even thinking about it to this day. You know, before digital, we used a black and white darkroom and printed the pictures by hand. And so I had all these unique black and white pictures that will never be seen again. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
If I do have wrestling pictures, I do have a few pictures on disc. But what I used to have, they will never be seen again, you know. So
yeah, that's too bad.
My goal is to gather the good ones and to print and do photo shows like I did in the 90s. You know, I did photo shows, and it really a lot of attention was brought to me, and the TV crew would come out and I'd be on the news, and you know, the thing is about living the moment like I did, you know, it's like heroin. You never want it to stop. And now now that I'm getting older and I've had a few health problems, everything is kind of slowing down, but your mind still thinks you could do it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, and you're still out there, right? Recently, you know,
did a
show managing. I mean, you're still here and there doing your thing.
It was the Don Basher Memorial show, the fifth one. And so I got to manage again. And once again, it was the hot dog and Coke as my pay. But I still had a good time. And it feels good to still somewhat be relevant in the business. You know, the fans that knew me from the 80s, they're all dead now, so I was able to perform. Who's that old guy up there? He's probably going to die of a heart attack, but I still had a good time. And every once in a while at one of these shows, an old timer comes up, and I'm able to reconnect with them, like Bobby Colt or Bobo Brazil Jr. He wasn't there at this one. And you know, normally they would have a big spread for the with food for the memorial show, but this time it was this one they didn't have it. But I want to thank Joey Owens for giving me a chance to do it again. And you know, and so we were thinking we were going over the finish. Yeah, I forgot the name of my team I manage. I apologize.
I think it was the highlight reel, right?
So we were going over the finish. And Pogo was on the opposite side. I think he's a baby face now. So it was a baby face match. And I'm asking the guy, I'm asking one of the highlight reels, what do you want me to do? And he's telling me, well, why don't you and Pogo brawl all the way to the back? And I said, brother, I'm 66 years old and I've had four strokes. I don't want to die. I don't want this to be my last hurrah, you know? I forgot what the finish was, but
can I just he'll grab a leg or something? Trip a guy.
Right. So as far as I remember, there was no interference. You know, it was like I said, it was a baby face match. They did a little tribute to Basher with all four of us. And that woman wrestler, she was part of the match as well. God, she is good. I can't remember her name. A little African-American girl. You probably remember. But I still had fun. It was, you know, I would perform in front of, you know, I have performed in front of thousands of people in my career. And I had just as much fun performing in front of 50 people. You know what
That's
I mean?
Right. That's right. That's right. Yeah. So, I was just going to say the book is available. You go to eatsleepwrestle.com. That's John's site. Or you can get it on Amazon.com. It's available there. Or if they can catch you at an event, they can get one directly from you signed.
And I will autograph it as well. That is true.
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, if anybody sees me, I've got a copy in my car. Cough up the money, and I will be glad to autograph the book for you. They're $20. And I'll make it personal to you. If you want one, send me an email or whatever. My email address is Scott@ScottRomer, R-O-M-E-R, photo, that's singular, .com. Mm-hmm. Scott@ScottRomerPhoto.com. Now, I'm not technically efficient, so... You know, I don't have a whole lot of, other than Facebook, I don't have a lot of accounts. If you really want one, you can message me on Facebook as well.
Yeah. Well, there you go. You can look up, you know, find him, Scott Romer, on Facebook. Message him there. Hit the email, Scott@ScottRomerPhoto.com. Or if worst case scenario, if anybody wants to shoot me a message, I'll make sure your message, I'll connect you with Scott. We'll make sure that connection's made. And, you know, why not just get it directly from Scott and you know, get it personalized to you and autographed? Best way to do it. Scott, again, it's a blast talking to you. We could talk for hours and hours and about so much stuff because you got, you've such a fascinating life.
I want to thank you for preserving the WWA tapes and putting them online. You know, I get a boner looking at old tapes that I haven't seen in a while. Knowing that they're in existence, thanks to you. So thank you very much for what you have done to preserve the legacy of the WWA.
Yeah, I mean, I try again. You know, my hot period for watching wrestling. I mean, Scott Rowe, or, you know, Saul Creechman. Was all over the TV. That was the guy. So, you know, good. I was watching avidly through the entire 80s. And I was turned on to wrestling from my grandma. I'm pretty sure, Scott, that my grandma probably hated your guts.
Then I did my job properly.
That's right.
One of the jobs that I did properly, but I did it right.
She watched avidly. She took me to my first show in her little town of Edinburgh, Indiana, at the high school gym. And, everything else. So I would admit my grandma was a complete mark. She hated the heels and loved the faces. And
bless her heart.
So that's right. She was your typical wrestling grandma. And she was wonderful. But Scott, again, I appreciate talking to you. And we'll do it again. I have no doubt.
David.
For
doors
something, we'll talk
you,
again.
My man.
Hey, you bums. We have to take a quick break.
Available on all streaming platforms. It's professional wrestling's greatest, largest, privately owned wrestling library. All the classic hits, flips, slams, and pins of yesteryear are on one place. It's Ultimate Classic Wrestling. Check out the Nature Boy Ric Flair, Hulk Hogan, Mr. USA Tony Atlas, Tito Santana, Rick Martel, a who's who of professional wrestling's greatest spotlight stars ever to grace the squared circle, all in one place. Grab the best seat in the house for memories and mayhem on Ultimate Classic Wrestling.
Hey guys, Ray Russell here, curator of the WrestleCopia Podcast Network, inviting you guys to listen to many of the programs here as part of the WrestleCopia brand, including, but not limited to, the Wrestling Memory Grenade, currently covering the 1988 and the WWF project. You can also listen to the Regional Wrestling Podcast, where we talk the territories, whether it's Jamie Ward with Georgia 81, Roman Gomez with the UWF in 1986, or Gene Jackson covering Memphis in 85. Three projects going on right now over there at Regional Wrestling. You can also listen to the Wrestling Stoop with the legend himself, Bob Roop. Bob goes back in time each and every week, covering not just his career, but countless stories and interactions with hundreds of wrestling names spanning his two decades in the business. But that's not all. You can also check out the Puro Wrestling Academy with the professor of Puro Resu, Mr. Dan Ginnity. Dan and I go back in time and cover the history of Japanese professional wrestling in the English language. And you can listen to all of those shows and more, all part of the WrestleCopia Podcast Network, located over at WrestleCopia.com. That's WrestleCopia.com, and anywhere your podcast streaming needs are met, from Apple to Spotify, Pocket Cast, and beyond. And while you're at it, why not subscribe to our social media guys for all the latest goings on here at the WrestleCopia Podcast Network. Plus, I'm constantly adding old school video clips and pictures from throughout wrestling history. You can follow us over on X, formerly Twitter, at Wrestling Grenade. That's at R-A-S-S-L-I-N Grenade. Also, follow and like me, Facebook.com/Wrestling Grenade. And why not subscribe to YouTube.com/Wrestling Grenade. So if you're looking to support that next up-and-coming podcast brand, please consider making it WrestleCopia.
We're back on Wrestling Nostalgia.
All right, and thank you to Scott for coming on the show. You've been on before. Thank you for coming on again, and I'm sure he'll be back probably several times in the future. I always enjoy talking to Scott. He's got lots of great stories, a fascinating life. Done so much, and go get his book, guys. It's can't recommend it enough. While you're out there, also go follow me on X. I am at The Dave Dynasty. It's the best place to follow me on social media. Also, go check out all the WrestleCopia network of podcasts. You can go to WrestleCopia.com or look up the individual shows on your favorite podcast platform. Also, be sure to go check out my friends at the Ultimate Classic Wrestling Library. Go to ClassicWrestling.net and sign up for your account, and then download the Ultimate Classic Wrestling app on all of your smart devices. Watch social media. Like I said, follow me. My next guest will be announced in the coming days on social media. As I said, I'm getting my scheduling smoothed out. I have lots of, if you follow me on social media, or at least on Facebook, you know that I'm in the process of purchasing a home in Florida, so I'm getting ready to relocate. So lots going on with that. I'm going to try for it to not take away from the show, but there will probably be at least 1 week in there somewhere where we won't have an episode because of the move and everything else. I'll keep you posted. Maybe I'll try to maybe double up on an interview, maybe in pre-schedule if I can. I don't know. So much is going on in such a short amount of time that it's crazy, guys. So be patient with me. But until then, hopefully everybody's doing well. And wherever you go and whatever you do, be good, be safe, and always keep on growing.
Fans, we brought you All-Star Championship Wrestling. This is Sam Manager thanking you for being with us and saying until next time, so long, everyone.
Wrestling Nostalgia is copyright Dave Dynasty. Bruiser voice done by John Lawson.